On the matter of State versus McCray and State versus Gabriel, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, can we please have appearances? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Soto.
May it please the court, I respectfully request 2 minutes of rebuttal time only if necessary. Mr. McCray is alleged to have violated his pretrial release by committing a new offense. Mr. Gabriel is alleged to have violated a curfew condition imposed as part of his pretrial release. In both cases, the state argues that this conduct justifies prosecution for fourth-degree criminal contempt. In both instances, the state is wrong. The plain language of the Criminal Justice Reform Act does not authorize the state to prosecute defendants for criminal contempt for all violations of pretrial release. Contempt is not a word found anywhere in the CJRA. Instead, Section 24 of that statute includes a revocation mechanism by which, through motion of the prosecutor, the trial court can determine whether the defendant's release should be continued in conformity with the goals of the CJRA or whether the defendant should be detained. This revocation section is the remedy, and detention is the possible punishment that the legislature considered appropriate for violations of conditions of pretrial release. Additionally, when the legislature wants contempt to serve as a punishment for a violation of an order, it has explicitly said so in its enactments. The Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, the Protective Order Act, and the recently enacted Extreme Risk Protective Order Act all explicitly list contempt as a remedy for violations of orders entered under those statutes. The legislature has also amended the contempt statute itself to include those violations. No such similar contempt language was included in the CJRA, nor was the contempt statute amended by the legislature to include violations of pretrial release. And the reason for that is obvious. The legislature did not intend for criminal contempt to serve as a remedy for all pretrial release violations. The legislative history could not be any clearer on this point. The legislature considered contempt in the introductory versions of the CJRA and rejected it, removing all mentions of contempt from the CJRA before finalizing its final version of that act. Finally, practical application of the state's position would make the CJRA completely unworkable and would lead to absurd results. Under the state's logic, it has the unbridled discretion to charge defendants with fourth-degree criminal contempt for any violation of pretrial release, regardless of the severity of that violation. This discretion would likely lead to disparity in contempt charging practices across the state, depending on the county and the nature of the violations involved. Application of the state's argument could also result in situations where prosecutors could prosecute a defendant for contempt for a release violation despite the trial court having found that that violation did not justify revocation of that release. In 2018, 3,052 revocation motions were filed by our prosecutors. Of those, 849 were denied by our courts. Under the state's logic, the state could prosecute defendants for fourth-degree criminal contempt in all of those cases, including those where release was continued by our courts. Your Honors, the CJRA's plain language and legislative history, coupled with the impractical results that would flow from application of the state's argument, lead to the conclusion that contempt is simply not a remedy for all violations of pretrial release. Accordingly, this court should reverse the decision of the Appellate Division. Your Honors, that concludes my opening statement.
Can you tell us, in the experience of the public defender, was this practice in place before the Criminal Justice Reform Act went into effect, where individuals who violated a condition that included bail, monetary bail, sanctioned with contempt violations?
No, not that I'm aware of, and not in my practice. Under the bail statute, the remedy for a bail violation was possible revocation of that bail or increase of that bail. Fourth-degree contempt was never tacked on as an additional remedy under the bail system, which is an important fact here to note, given that the CJRA changed so much of that previous system. Due to the inequalities that bail system had created with regards to the financial disparity between different defendants. So it doesn't make sense that a system, the CJRA, which the opening statement of the CJRA says it's liberally construed to require or to urge release where it can be imposed, would also include a remedy of criminal contempt in those cases.
Would you allow for an exception for no contact orders per our opinion in State versus Gandhi?
Yes, and I think that's what the language in Gandhi was discussing. No contact orders are different. Those were imposed prior to the enactment of the CJRA, and that's what the language, this court's language in that case was discussing, that those orders are essentially separate from the bail order even when they are entered at the same time. And the reason for that makes sense, because in this context, for example, in the McRae case, he actually was subject to a no-contact order. Now, we know from the facts his violation is the new offense that resulted in him being detained. But that didn't mean that while he was in the jail, he could start now contacting the victims. The no-contact order essentially outlasted the release order that was ultimately revoked in this case. And no contact orders are judicial orders under 29-9A. That section of the contempt statute makes it clear that judicial orders and protective orders, if they're violated, they
On conditions of release, judicial orders also?
Well, these are conditional orders, Your Honor. And
but they're still judicial orders, don't they fit under the statute?
I submit no, because our case law makes a distinction between conditional orders and judicial orders. Judicial orders are direct orders to a defendant to do something or not to do something, punishment which it could be contempt.
If some one of the conditions of release is that they do not do something beyond the no contact, is it, would it then be a judicial order?
I'm sorry.
If the release, the order for release provides that the person do certain things or not engage in certain things, wouldn't that be a judicial order at that point, not a conditional order?
No, because the requirements that are placed under a defendant in a conditional order are statutory conditions to the release order. The best hypothetical I can give, hypothetical I can give is the purpose of the release order, it's not directing a defendant to release himself. It's directing another authority, the jail, pretrial services. It's letting them know that this person can be released subject to these statutory conditions.
If the no contact order is part of the release order, Would that not become a conditional order, or would it remain a judicial order?
Well,
because the one we discussed, there was already an order, no contact order in place. But if that no contact order was placed as a result of the release, would that then be a conditional order?
The no contact order could be treated as a condition, but also has that additional remedy under the contempt statute because it is a judicial order, and that's what the language in Gandhi
discussed. Well, why are you making a distinction between a conditional order and a judicial order? Why don't you just say it's a conditional judicial order? I mean, it is some form of judicial order, but it's of a conditional nature.
Right, correct. Okay. And another thing to keep in mind is the conditions are imposed pursuant to a statute that includes a remedy, and that's Section 24 of this statute, which allows the prosecutor to file a motion to revoke, and then at that point it's within the trial court's hands to decide whether or not the violation requires additional conditions or detention in that case.
Can I ask you about your legislative history argument?
Sure.
Because you say that the statute changed, and you point to the introductory section, which originally said relying upon contempt of court proceedings or criminal sanctions, and that was when the statute was originally focused on a more traditional bail system.
Correct.
And then it changed rather dramatically to the current CJRA. And when it did, it did drop the contempt language, as you point out, but it uses language that says, for the purposes of primarily relying upon pretrial release. And then when it talks about sanctions, the other section that you were referring to, it says may include, but it doesn't read as if it's an exhaustive list of the things that the court could impose. Can you address that?
I think the reason why it is written that way is that it has to include scenarios such as if a defendant is arrested, that may include a new arrest. If he fails to appear, that may require a bench warrant, which could lead to his arrest. So it's taking into account those various scenarios that could result. I think it's noteworthy that criminal contempt is a very significant penalty. If the legislature wanted that to apply, it would have listed that amongst those other possibilities in that sanction section.
Even though Rule 110
was arrested for new offenses, and that's theft and forgery.
Correct.
So why is it that they couldn't bring contempt charges against him for those violations?
Well, because the CJRA doesn't allow it. Now, they can charge him with the theft and forgery. I'm not denying that. Mm-hmm. That is the remedy for the new offenses. But the CJRA also doesn't allow the prosecution to tack on a contempt charge because it's not a remedy exclusively listed in the CJRA.
My question to you before, though, is did it have to be? Since it wasn't, the statute was not written as if it was listing an exclusive list of potential sanctions.
I think, Your Honor, if you look at these other statutes where the legislature does want contempt to apply, they explicitly say it. So it doesn't make sense that in this context they would just not mention it. The one example I gave, the Extreme Risk Protective Order Act, was enacted in 2018 and just became effective last September. So that statute was enacted after this statute was already in effect. So clearly the legislature follows a theme. If they want contempt to apply, they list it in the enactment, and then they amend the contempt statute itself to include that violation to point back to the enactment.
You also point to the difference in language of the D.C. statute and the federal statute. When I look at the language in those two acts, they speak in different language. They're talking about the authority of the court to act.
Correct.
And then they have the separate section about how the proceedings could be instituted by the court itself.
Correct.
Now, of course, we have Rule 110.2. Which allows the court to proceed with criminal contempt. Did it have to find a way to insert, did the legislature need to find a way to insert that proactive action by the court in CJRA when most of the CJRA is speaking to the authority of prosecutors to initiate motions?
Well, I think with regards to our civil version of contempt, that would only apply in somewhat limited cases because I think one of the elements there is that the judge has to actually view the violation. So maybe in the failure to appear situation that could be lodged, and I think that's why the legislature didn't include it in the CJRA because it wouldn't cover all possible violations of a release order. For example, the curfew violation, that's not something a trial court would have been privy to seeing. Mm-hmm. That being said, I'm glad you brought up the federal and DC statutes because they do include a more civil type of contempt limited to, I think the D.C. statute, even though it calls it criminal contempt, it limits that version of contempt to only 6 months, a maximum of 6 months in jail, which is actually less than what the state is seeking in this case. They're seeking a fourth-degree crime that's obviously punishable by 18 months. And as our courts have recognized, our legislature did look to those statutes for influence and in some cases did decide to differentiate our statute from their statute. So I think it's noteworthy that our legislature did not enact that version of the revocation system under the federal and D.C. statutes, which is quite, it's much more detailed than what we have in our statute, but also that it didn't even incorporate that civil version of contempt, which is really included in those statutes.
Is it your position, tell me if I misheard you, that in order for contempt to be available as a remedy for the violation of a judicial order or protective order, contempt has to be in the substantive statute that addresses the order itself?
Right, correct.
So what's the purpose of Section 29.9a? Which provides persons guilty of a crime of the fourth degree if that person purposely or knowingly disobeys a judicial order or protective order.
Well, the protective order that references is under its own statute under 28-51.
Right.
And the judicial orders for other situations, such as the best example is the no contact order, that could be punishable because that is a direct judicial order. But I would point this court to the probation context where in State versus Williams, that court recognized that. And in a similar setting where probation, the statute includes its own remedy, contempt wasn't permitted to be superimposed on top of what the remedy is under the probation statute, which is possible revocation and resentencing. And that's because there the court found that the probation order is a conditional order. The conditions are based on the statute that includes its own remedy. Mm-hmm. And that's the same case here.
But Williams is no contact order. It's different from this case, right?
Correct, right. We don't have a no contact order issue in this situation. But I think it's noteworthy, even in practice today, people who violate probation aren't also being charged with contempt. The VOP is filed and they're brought before the court. And at that point, the court can decide if the violation warrants revocation and resentencing or maybe additional conditions. And that's similar to the CJRA.
Do we consider the interpretive canon of constitutional avoidance? So, for instance, If the basis for a contempt charge is possession of marijuana and the person is indicted for possession of marijuana, does that raise the specter of double jeopardy? And should we be considering constitutional avoidance so that we don't have to confront that type of situation?
So, yes, I think there is a double jeopardy concern here, especially, I mean, that attaches only when a new crime is the violation of the pretrial release order. I think there's a multiple prosecutions problem and a multiple punishments problem. With regards to multiple prosecutions, we do have the state, or United States versus Dixon, which discussed what happens if essentially the elements of the new offense are included in the contempt order, in the contempt charge itself. So I think there is a problem there. But even if in where both charges, the contempt and the new crime, are charged together, you have a multiple punishments problem. There could be situations where a defendant is charged with fourth degree contempt for having violated his pretrial release order by committing a third, second, or first degree crime.
Why doesn't all that apply to a no contact order?
The no contact order is its own defined crime. It's separate and distinct from the conditional order.
I understand, but I mean, tell me why the due process and the multiple prosecutions problems that you're raising wouldn't also apply to what you concede should be an exception.
Because the only crime that can be charged for the no contact order is the contempt. So in the situation I'm describing, it's a contempt, fourth degree contempt, and let's take Mr. McRae, for example, the third degree theft. If his violation had just been of a no contact order.
What if it's a harassment or even an assault that is involved with the violation of the no contact order? You could charge that, right?
Well, the no contact order the elements would still be different, because the elements of the contempt would be that he violated the no contact order. Then the harassment charge has separate elements
So you're saying no double jeopardy issue there?
Right.
You touched on this a little bit in your opening remarks, but could you tell us directly, does prosecution for contempt further the aims of the Criminal Justice Reform Act?
No, Your Honor, I definitely do not think so. And in fact, I think if anything, it would really hamper the system that all the stakeholders have worked so hard to create. As I noted, we have a situation where the legislature hasn't exactly spoken on whether or not contempt applies, and I'm arguing that it doesn't, but obviously my adversary is arguing that it does. If in fact that does apply, any violation of pretrial release can now be a fourth degree crime. We have the perfect example in this case. I have one client who violated his pretrial release by 2 hours. I have another client who committed a more severe violation by committing new offenses, yet both of this conduct is graded as a fourth degree offense. Without any of the legislature telling us that usually what they would do is if they wanted contempt to apply, they would at least grade it certain levels. I mean, we see that in the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. I believe violations there are graded on the fourth degree level, a DP level, dependent on what the nature is. We don't have that here.
Could the notice provision, if it was enforced more rigorously, answer some of those concerns?
In what way, Your Honor?
Section 23, which requires the court to notify the defendant of the conditions and the penalties, which may include issuance of a warrant for arrest. Obviously, that means it could include other things with proper, more specific notice as to what could flow from violation of conditions of release. Would that satisfy the problem you're raising now?
I don't think it would satisfy the actual practical application of the state's argument, but I think it would at least put defendants on notice that this is a possibility. If you violate a pretrial release order, you could be charged with fourth degree contempt, regardless of what that violation may be.
Mm-hmm. Does that dovetail into your argument that you're concerned about the level of, or the unbridled discretion, I think is how you described it, to prosecutors to pick and choose violations to proceed on the basis of contempt on?
Well, Your Honor, that in my experience, that has essentially been happening since this CJRA has become in effect. We've seen disparate practices with regard to contempt charging all across the state. Some counties would do it, then they would stop. Others never did it. And it's still going on in that way. And another problem that we've been seeing, too, is that prosecutors have been using these contempt charges as essentially a leverage or a bargaining tool to try to get defendants to plead guilty to the charges that they've already been released on. I've been, myself and a colleague in my office have worked extensively with CJRA issues since even before the act was passed, and oftentimes, especially after the CJRA, of course, was enacted, we'd get calls from attorneys from our office saying that my client got charged with fourth-degree contempt for violation, and we would always tell them, okay, file a motion to dismiss based on the arguments I set forth in my brief before this court, and oftentimes those attorneys would call us back just to tell us that, well, I was going to file that motion, but the state offered to either dismiss the contempt or run it concurrent, and the deal was just too good. And I think that's almost a play on what the problem with the bail system was, this disparity that was causing defendants to, especially those who could not afford very minimal bails, to essentially sit in jail for lengthy periods of time to the point that they were taking time-served pleas just to get out. So I don't think that's, I think there's the potential for abuse if contempt is also permitted to be charged for violations of pretrial release. Your Honors, I also want to note that we do have a pretty significant penalty in the CJRA, detention. Jail is a form of punishment. I think if you were to ask any of my clients whether being in jail pretrial is some form of punishment, they would all agree that it is. So I think we have to keep in mind that the statute itself has a pretty strict possibility of what could happen to a defendant if he or she does in fact violate. They could be in jail pre-trial without being released. So I think we have to also keep that in mind, that the penalty itself is also pretty severe.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the Court, I'd like to begin by answering a question that Justice Patterson asked, then I'd like to talk a little bit about the legislative history, I'd like to talk about administrability, and I'd like to talk about absurd results. Justice Patterson, you asked defendants' counsel whether a statute that provided the court the authority to issue an order had to explicitly list contempt as a possible sanction if the legislature wanted contempt to be available, and I have a slightly different answer than Ms. Lasota, which is no, but if they list possible sanctions and don't list contempt, then we can assume that it is not available. So they could be totally silent on what was available, but the Criminal Justice Reform Act is not totally silent on what is available.
We have this language in 23A that leaves some room, mm-hmm. right? It talks about, make sure my notes are correct, that there are consequences, conditions, penalties for, and other consequences that could include arrest. It doesn't tell us what the others may be.
Right, and so there I'd rely on Ms. Lasota's recitation of all the other statutes that actually do list contempt and the amendments that were made to contempt. I'd also direct you to the bail jumping statute, which is 29-7, and the bail jumping statute, which provides for this separate prosecution for bail jumping, says nothing in this shall preclude prosecutions for contempt as otherwise provided. So the legislature knows how to say contempt remains available and didn't hear.
So what are the penalties for and other consequences of violating conditions under the CJRA other than arrest?
So there are several. You can starting with ratcheted up conditions. So a defendant who is reporting once a month might now have to report twice a month. A defendant who is not subject to home detention might now be subject to home detention. A defendant who didn't have a curfew might now have a curfew. There are all sorts of...
That seems to fit within consequences, but what about penalties? There are two words in that clause that Justice Patterson read to you.
So the only penalty I can think of is detention, and I would agree with Ms. Lasota that it is a significant penalty. Here's the thing. We've been talking a lot about the legislative history, and I think it's important to look at the omission from the first draft. But what is totally ignored in the state's brief is the Joint Committee on Criminal Justice. Joint Committee on Criminal Justice, which this court has recognized as a significant influencer over the legislative action, was very clear about what sanctions and penalties should be allowed for violations of pretrial release orders. It's page 65 of the March 10th, 2014 report, and it talks about graduated sanctions culminating with the most serious being detention. And so there really is no mystery. To the extent there's any mystery in the legislative history, if we look back to the Joint Committee, they're very clear on what the top should be. And that was a unanimously joined recommendation by the Attorney General, by the County Prosecutors Association.
It would also seem to me perhaps strange that the legislature would specifically take out the contempt provision so that we could just puzzle over this at a hearing like this before the Supreme Court.
Especially given the extrinsic evidence like the Joint Committee. So that's what I wanted to say about legislative history. I'd like to turn to administrability, and I've got three things I'd like to raise there, for police, for prosecutors, and for defendants. So starting with police, there's this puzzling portion of the County Prosecutors Association brief where they say, listen, police are trained that they can arrest for violations of the CJRA, and if we have a rule that zigs and zags that allows for PDVA violations but doesn't allow for general CJRA violations, that'll be really confusing to police officers. So two responses to that. The first is if you look at the PDVA, which explicitly authorizes contempt orders, it actually only explicitly authorizes them for certain violations. So you can get it for violation of a no-contact order, but not for a violation of a child support order. And so police should already know that they have to draw certain lines. But the other thing is this. We're talking about 140,000 people minus roughly 8,000. 140,000 people charged on complaints or summonses, 8,000 who get detained. So you're looking at 130,000 people who have conditions of release. Under the County Prosecutors Association, we're going to ask police, their version, we'd ask police to enforce every single order applicable to all 130,000 people. Under the version put forth by the defendant, by amicus, and I think by several people, my friends on the other side, we would say, just focus on the no-contact orders. Just focus on the orders that directly impact public safety. And actually, I'm going to clarify the no-contact order thing, if you give me a minute. But that is a better use of policing resources and more consistent with what the legislature was trying to do than saying, police everything. Police whether someone showed up late to court by 5 minutes or missed a curfew by an hour. Let's focus on the real stuff. So I do want to say, Justice Albin, you asked whether under Gandhi we could have an exception for violations of no contact order. I think the answer is yes. And I think there's another exception that calls out, which is also contained in the PDVA, because there's authority in the PDVA for bail-setting judges, release-setting judges, to issue three kinds of orders on top of the release order: no contact provisions, forfeiture of weapons provisions, and then a provision relating to pets. So as to the first two, I think it is fair to say that violation of either of those orders, a no contact or a turn over your weapons order, would be contempt under the PDVA. The CJRA didn't revoke the PDVA. The Attorney General says so much in their in its directive to county prosecutors.
Can you distinguish for us, help distinguish this particular type of no contact order from other conditions, other orders that are contained? Take a stab.
Sure.
The drafting an opinion.
The first place I'll start is that the authority for judges in the domestic violence context, the authority for judges to set a no contact order does not derive from the CJRA, though there is also authority there. It derives from the PDVA, which predates the CJRA by many years, which says in NJSA 2C25-26 that when a judge is setting bail, she may issue a no-contact order, order the defendant to turn over his weapons, and make certain orders with respect to pets. So I think the fact that the source of authority is separate and apart, and that gets us to Gandhi, which is to say that the no-contact order doesn't lose its import because it happens to be part of a bail order, or in this case, a release order.
Mr. Shalom, you distinguished earlier the no-contact order said that was an issue of public safety?
Yes.
And you distinguished that. In this case, I think Mr. McRae stole a wallet from a stroller, I'm assuming a baby stroller. Isn't that part of public safety also?
It is.
Taking something from a
the question,
child stroller?
Justice Fernandez-Vina, is not whether people on pretrial release might misbehave. We can think of lots of things that impact
public
safety.
I'm asking about the distinction you made that the no-contact order dealt with public safety, so perhaps contempt would be appropriate. But in this case, can we agree that
we
taking a wallet from a stroller, not from a person, from a baby stroller?
is issue of public safety?
Sure, but it's not relevant to this inquiry, which is, do we need contempt to protect public safety? The legislature has seen fit to criminalize taking wallets from baby strollers, and there's a penalty that is associated with that, and we assume that that's sufficient to deter people from doing that, or if it's not, they get punished. The point on the no-contact order is that with, and this is the point that's made in the domestic violence advocate's brief, that without contempt as the stick in no-contact orders, it's not enough. The mere threat of revocation is not enough to make the no-contact order.
The no-contact orders go beyond domestic violence situations. Even Gandhi wasn't a domestic violence
case. That's correct.
It was a stalking case.
That is correct.
So you're not making a distinction, are you, between domestic violence no-contact orders and those that are intended to keep the defendant away from an alleged victim?
But you are making a distinction with when it involves a baby in a stroller, as I understand it.
I'm not making any distinction about babies and strollers. Justice Albin, you're correct that no-contact orders have an import beyond the domestic violence context. I think the weapons piece is probably
I want
to
see
special
what you're, I'm
to
trying
the
to understand
PBA.
Your position. You're willing to accept a carve-out for no-contact orders, whether they're related to domestic violence or not.
Yes, because I think to not do so would lead to absurd results, and I will get to that. If I can just finish on administrability, I've talked about police. I'd like to talk about prosecutors, because what the Attorney General and the County Prosecutors Association say is, look, we're never going to be able to prosecute these in every case, so just give us the authority to do it in 130,000 cases, and we will use our discretion to figure out the right ones. The problem with that is this. When we think about what is the stick of contempt do, what does a fourth-degree charge do, it's most impactful on the lowest-level charges. Right? A defendant who's looking at 30 years on attempted murder is not super worried about the additional 18 months without NERA that might come from a contempt charge. Whereas a defendant who's looking at a probationary sentence or a brief prison sentence, that amount of time really matters. So there's this weird thing where the stick is heavier in the cases where it matters the least. And the other problem is this. Which people are going to get the stick? And it's people that make life difficult for prosecutors. That is, people who go to trial. We already have enough disincentives to going to trial saying, look, we're going to give the prosecutor the choice of either proceeding with this case or not, unbridled choice. They're not going to, in most cases, as Ms. Lissota said, they'll wrap it in, they'll make it concurrent, or they'll dismiss it. But if you go to trial, then you're looking at 18 months. That is both bad from a public policy standpoint and exactly the sort of thing that the Joint Committee talked about in trying to make our system fairer, was to not penalize defendants who are in or defendants who are poor, not penalize people extra for going for exercising their rights.
Outside of the contempt scenario, you're not arguing that the police cannot arrest a defendant for a violation of the terms of his release, or are you?
I am not arguing that, but
I the only reason why I raise that is because you were talking about policing, and that would seem to me to be permissible policing, no?
Well, it depends. I don't think police can arrest someone because they've appeared in court 5 minutes late. That is, I think what has to happen,
but for
order.
But for violating a curfew?
I don't know that they can do so without a warrant. I mean, I think the question is, does it trigger a bench warrant?
Presence, they see the violation of an order. It is an order. Conditional, however you want to characterize it. It's a condition of your release pursuant to a judicial order.
People have been picked up when they're violating curfews from halfway houses. We've seen those. It's similar,
insofar as the statute provides as one possible remedy, arrest, I suppose you're right. Arrest as distinct from prosecution.
Right.
Okay. I think there are lots of reasons that it's bad public policy, but I can't argue that the statute precludes such policing.
But the statute would then kick in terms of the standard that would be required to be found by a court in order to revoke release.
Right. That's right, and I have no reason to think that our courts have done anything other than an admirable job in figuring out the difference between de minimis violations and serious ones that trigger revocation. I mean, the standard is very clear in the statute, and I think courts are getting it right. Last piece on administrability goes to defendants. which is we are processing more than 100,000 defendants a year through these release hearings. They're happening very quickly, statutorily within 48 hours, by court rule, almost all of them within 24 hours. And if you watch those hearings, they're very quick. There's a lot of agreement. Most conditions are set by consent. And that's largely because defendants are happy to be out. And so the difference between fighting between twice a month reporting and once a month reporting isn't worth their time. If, however, failure to show up at that pretrial services officer's appointment is going to lead to a fourth degree charge, you better believe that Mr. Krikora is going to tell his attorneys to stop consenting, to fight tooth and nail, to prevent every single condition of release that is not necessary as required by the statute. So there's all this, it's very amicable now, and it won't be if the consequence is a fourth degree charge for each time you miss an appointment or do anything like that.
Can I bring you back to no contact orders?
Of course.
Because you've advocated thoughtfully for a workable middle ground. Give us a principled way to get there that would cover no contact orders broadly, including those, as we discussed, that go beyond the PDVA.
So I think you bring me to my last point, Chief Justice Ravner, which is the doctrine of trying to interpret a statute in a way to avoid absurd results. It is very clear that the two poles, and to be clear, no one is actually advocating for the one pole. The one pole is any violation can be charged as contempt, and the other is no violations can, and no one's pushing for that. But both of those ends lead to totally absurd results. On the one hand, on the more criminalization, it is exactly counter to the legislative purpose, which is to be decarcerative and get more people at liberty pretrial. It doesn't make sense to have more people at liberty pretrial, only to have many more people in prison after trial. That's one of the absurd results. And the other is the idea that there would be no enforcement mechanism for no contact orders when there was an enforcement mechanism for no contact orders under the old system, where judges had far less authority to utilize non-monetary conditions to incentivize behavior. So if under Gandhi, violations of a no contact order in a non-DV context was allowed to be prosecuted with contempt, it just doesn't make sense to say we want to scale that back.
So what's the description of the types of orders that you would say should be in this exception, knowing that just a reference to Gandhi, that's one scenario, that's the stalking scenario, is not going to provide the entire definition.
So I think any no-contact order, whether it is for a domestic violence victim, any victim, or any witness, a lay witness, I think would apply with equal force. Any no-contact order would be enforceable by charging contempt. And then the only additional thing that I would say, Justice Patterson, would be the failure to turn over weapons when ordered pursuant to the PDVA. But I will say that is a place where contempt is probably unnecessary, because I think if the order has been made under the PDVA, the continued possession of the weapon makes the person a certain person. So a second degree offense, so the hammer of a fourth degree offense is small potatoes compared to the second degree offense. But so the if I were writing the opinion, Justice Patterson, the carve out would be for any order of no contact to any person.
You were saying PDVA has three components: no contact, weapons, and we're leaving the pets aside.
I'm going to leave that to Mr. Novak to handle. I'm sure there is an application of it, but I'm not sufficiently well versed to do
it. Okay.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Meacham.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This Court was clear in Gandhi that as long as a court order exists and the defendant has knowledge of it, the defendant may be prosecuted for a violation under our contempt statute. Just because a judicial order is issued in connection with defendant's release under the CGRA does not render it suddenly unenforceable by contempt. This is true according to the plain language of both the contempt statute and the CGRA. As this Court said, orders prescribing conditions of release do not lose their character as judicial orders merely because bail consequences would attach for that violation. Nowhere in Ghani did this court say, and that's only true for no contact or certain types of order. The language in Ghani is very, very clear. A court order that exists does not change because of release conditions that attach to it. The CJRA's primary purpose to rely on pretrial release that's set forth clearly in the statute is also achieved, as this court explained in Robinson, in addition to the CJRA's primary purpose of relying on pretrial release, the CJRA also has the primary purposes, and this court explained this in Robinson, to assure a defendant's return to court, protect public safety, and the integrity of the criminal justice process. Those purposes are just as important and need to be enforced under the CJRA in addition to relying on release of defendants. Though this primary purpose is best served by not only relying on revocation as a remedy for release, but also allowing contempt charges. Simply, there are scenarios where a defendant's revocation and detention after violating release condition is not appropriate. The standard court must find in order to revoke defendant's release is not just based on whether a violation occurs. There is a sort of recalculation of the initial three purposes of the CJRA, whether the public safety is at risk, the obstruction of the criminal justice process, or the defendant's ability to appear in court. So while the burden is again on the state at those revocation proceedings, there may be scenarios where revocation is not appropriate despite a violation having occurred. And so we need to also allow another option besides revocation in those scenarios where revocation is not appropriate, especially where, again, the purpose of the CJRA is to rely on release. So we need to have something else in between besides revoking or letting a defendant enjoy impunity. As the Appellate Division explained, the CJRA system cannot succeed unless defendants who are released on conditions comply with those conditions. And as this court said in Gandhi, we insist on compliance under pain of penalty with judicial orders to promote order and respect for the judicial process. The safety of the community and the integrity of the criminal justice process is dependent, especially under this new system where thousands of more defendants are being released. That was the intent, and that is what's happening, right? So this system where there is more individuals being released, that is dependent on those people following those orders. Otherwise, our system cannot continue to the safety of the community and to respect the criminal justice process. So we need to allow prosecutors to charge contempt to enforce those orders and guarantee the success of the CJRA.
Are you done with your argument? You don't think that the fear of reincarceration is a sufficient hammer hanging over the defendant's head?
It depends on a defendant's sophistication, but if he knew that I talked to his attorney the first time, really low PSA scores, that he had no prior history, that there is a good chance that the prosecutors lost their detention motion the first time, they would lose it again.
You really think that's the type of calculation? I think I will violate my curfew, get myself arrested, and I think the weighing when I go before a judge will favor me for re-release.
Well, I really
think that calculation is going to happen?
Well, there's some defendants who know that this system is encouraging people to be released, and so they may rely on that basic concept. But another answer to your question is, we know from Salerno, and this court explained this also in Robinson, that prisoner detention cannot be punished. So if it is, it violates due process, if we're allowing people to be punished prior to trial.
You have to explain one thing to me. And I raise this to the adversary. What I'm trying to figure out is, since there was a proposal in the original legislation for a contempt provision, why would the legislature remove it in order to create this ambiguity so that we can all gather here today to puzzle this out? Why?
So I don't think it's ambiguous at all, and I think the legislature took it out because it is there already. But we read our statutes as a whole, right? So it's there in 29.9. The language is clear, it's a judicial order. So there, in my opinion, there's nothing to wonder. There's nothing to even puzzle over. So no need to repeat it. I guess you can think of it as a way, why repeat it if it's there in 29.9?
So help us understand the limits, the outer limits of your argument, because both defendants in this case had orders which directed them, among other things, to appear for all scheduled court proceedings, which is very common. We know, it's published data, how frequently a defendant will miss one court proceeding. Is it your position the state can prosecute each individual for a fourth-degree crime for missing a single court appearance?
So, Mr. Shalom mentioned this. I think the bail jumping statute would be more appropriate charge in that scenario, but that statute does reserve for contempt. So, and there's been no allegation of a charge of contempt being filed with an.
I'm asking a different question. What's your understanding, and how are you reading the statute? Does it allow prosecutions in those tens of thousands of cases now over the course of 3 years?
I think it does, but that's not to say that makes it any sort of violation or that it actually will be occurring every single time.
Understood. So what is it that the legislature has said that leads you to that conclusion as you look at the statute?
I mean, I think it comes down to basic prosecutorial authority, right? Discretion for charging, and the concept that prosecutors are trying to log up their own caseload and the court's caseload is just it hasn't happened and it won't happen.
Well, I'm trying to understand the breadth of the prosecutorial discretion that you're arguing. Are you arguing that you can arrest a person and charge the person with contempt for failure to maintain employment? Because that would be one of the conditions. Or failure to commence an educational program, which would also be a condition. Or there are a bunch of conditions like that.
Or failure to make good efforts in those regards.
Right. Those are all judicial orders. And I would love to be able to say to you, no contact orders are allowed and other orders are not allowed. I just don't see that principally in the statute or in the orders themselves.
So you're saying that the legislature has reserved to prosecutors the authority to charge fourth degree contempt charges for those types of violations, the ones that I just mentioned.
Yes, because I don't see anywhere in the statute or in prior case law that says only certain violations.
So how do any of these violations that we've just discussed further the aims, contempt prosecutions for these violations, further the aims of the criminal justice reform?
Well, a judge would not be issuing release conditions if they were not necessary for the safety of the community, the criminal justice process, and the defendant's appearance, right? So we're assuming the judge, and we know the judge is issuing those conditions, the least restrictive conditions, right, before defendants can be released. So I'm not in that case, but that there is some reason that judge decided that an educational program was necessary for those three things. And so we're not going to second guess that decision, but we will enforce the order.
So this theoretical possibility existed before the Criminal Justice Reform Act as well. Many of these very conditions were part of conditions where monetary bail was set as well. Were people charged with contempt? And give us a sense of the practice prior to 2017.
So dating back to 1972, in Johnson and Kareki, the authority for conditions were there. And this court recognized in Gandhi, at least it occurred in the Gandhi case have occurred.
I don't want to sound facetious. I'm trying to get a sense of the scope of contempt prosecutions prior to CJRA.
So
an isolated case here or there. Was it a practice in your experience representing the Attorney General or not?
I don't have numbers. I mean, maybe the County Prosecutor Association can speak to sort of more about how it was occurring in the counties. I mean, under the prior system, a lot more defendants were being detained, right? And so I think you weren't at least in our office, we weren't having as much release in the release conditions that I experienced because improperly so, defendants were in jail. So there wasn't maybe as much of a need. I think that's the difference under the CGRA, right? If to the extent that it maybe was not occurring as much before, that's because under our new system now, we have a new need for it because so many more defendants, we have presumptions of release, presumptions of summons, the numbers of summons have gone up and released, so we have a different system.
Let me ask you to turn your attention to after the act, after CJRA. How often, where there is not a new offense, are the defendants charged with criminal contempt, fourth degree? How often?
So I can't give you...
No offense.
Yeah.
Just violation of the order.
I mean, we know Gabrielle. I mean, I could speak from sort of...
I know there's two here, but...
Yeah.
I'm thinking generally.
Appellate context. I mean, I know we had a case out of Salem County and Mercer County. Judge Susswine issued on it. Those were all not new offenses.
Not new offenses, violation of the order, contempt charged.
Right.
In any of those cases, no new offense, contempt charged, did it result in detention of the defendant? In any of those cases?
I think...
It's a tool in the toolbox now.
Yeah, I think in the Mercer case the defendant was detained. I'm not sure about the Salem.
See, I would really like to know, and this is more of a practical question than anything else. I think the chief is trying to get at it. Why? Why bother charging contempt? If there really a risk of danger, if there's a violation of the spirit and intent of the CJRA, try to lock them up. Judge's got the discretion. Eventually you're going to make the decision.
Right.
Try to lock them up. There are risks to the community. There are threat to committed offense, threat to a witness, a victim, whatever.
Right.
And if you're not going to be able to incarcerate them and alleviate that risk, to what end is the fourth degree offense charged? To what end?
So that question, you have to think, is really you're asking police, right? When they witness, in Gabrielle, for example, when they witness a violation, you're asking them to say, oh, don't worry about it, it's fine.
No. You're asking them to notify the court
right.
And for them to be brought in and perhaps incarcerated.
But so
You're asking them to take action. You're not saying anybody turn the other way.
Yeah.
The ability to take action, perhaps detain the defendant and alleviate the risk, is there. Is the fourth degree offense going to change any of that?
Yes, because it's very different than for a police officer to be able to go and arrest an individual for violating a no-contact order or a curfew, or them to just go back into their car and make a phone.
They can already arrest them for violating the no-contact
order.
They can already arrest them for violating the no-contact order, violation of the Domestic Violence Act.
Well, unless it's not a domestic violence case, or the victim hasn't filed a restraining order, right? And our experience, victims, you know, sometimes don't file, or they will withdraw filing. That happens
a lot. It's a cycle of violence.
There may be a
difference between the authority of the police to make an arrest and the ability of the prosecutor to pursue a contempt proceeding. So for a violation of the terms of release, the police may be able to arrest the person, and then there'll be a further detention hearing rather than a contempt hearing. So your colleagues are not necessarily arguing against policing. What they're arguing against is a separate prosecution for contempt.
It's a great question, and that's the problem is, if there's no charge, what is the arrest for? If there's no bench warrant yet, and there's no charge, a police cannot just arrest and detain someone.
Violation of the terms of release, provided that the police know it. For instance, a violation of a curfew.
A police cannot arrest and detain someone without probable cause to believe a crime has been committed, or they have a bench warrant. And this is something the lower court judge explained in Gabrielle, that you could just arrest somebody with no charge and then hold and then call the court. I'm not sure that's appropriate.
Is the point of this to create probable cause when there's no bench warrant for the rearrest? Is the point of contempt being so important in the scheme of things, which I think is the theme of the questions you're getting, so that there is probable cause
that the crime is
criminal contempt? Is the reason this is such a focus in this setting to give officers the ability to arrest without a bench warrant?
Yes. I mean, I don't think that under the Fourth Amendment you can arrest and detain someone without probable
cause. So in 2016, if an officer had arrested someone, obtained an order that included a curfew, and then a week later saw that person out on the street after the curfew,
mm-hmm.
no recourse? They'd have to go to the court before and have to just walk away from the individual on the street?
No, because my position is that they could have charged it under the old system as well. It's a violation of a court order is 2C 29-9. So that hasn't changed. It's a judicial order, and I don't believe there's any distinction between conditional. Not it's a judicial order, and I also don't see the distinction between why only certain parts of a judicial order can be enforced. Again, if I could see that in the law, I would love to say that as sort of a saving them. I don't see it there.
I'm trying to understand this argument. Are you saying that police officers do not have authority to arrest someone for a violation of probation when the violation doesn't constitute a separate crime?
I think under the current case, State versus Williams, the appellate division, they don't, because they can't charge contempt.
For a violation of probation?
I think the Williams case is pretty clear. The only remedy is revocation. I think that was...
Okay.
I think it should have.
We're talking about CJRA, right?
Are you talking about probation, or are you talking about Criminal Justice Reform Act?
I was talking about Criminal Justice Reform Act. I think Justice Alvin's question was about probation.
That's the BOP.
He gets arrested.
But you're saying no. You're saying from what I heard, please correct me if I'm wrong about this. I thought I heard you say that. If there is a violation of probation and the violation does not constitute an offense, there is no authority for the arrest?
I'm sorry. I think the probation context is a separate – obviously it's a separate scheme. I think the VOP, even though it's not a crime, does allow for arrest.
So you're saying they can be arrested?
Yeah. I think
and that's the same sort of conditional release that your colleagues are talking about. They're comparing it to probation. That's a judicial order of conditional release. Look at probation.
Right.
You can make the arrest, but you can't charge the person with contempt. So, why shouldn't we be making that comparison?
I'm not an expert in the probation context, but I thought there's a separate provision that allows for arresting someone with when they violate under VOP. I'm not 100% sure, but what I'm trying to say is I think that's a specific legislative proclamation in the probation context.
In Rule 3:21-7b, it says that the court may, and it cites 2C45-3A3, upon a showing of probable cause, have a defendant committed, that they've committed another offense, then detain somebody as a VOP.
Okay.
But it seems tied to committing another offense.
Right, right.
You think there's something else besides that?
I guess, to be clear, I'm not an expert in the probation context. Maybe the county prosecutor's office can help answer this question. But
wouldn't you expect that most arrests made for VOPs would be for new offenses as opposed to some other condition of probation?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think the context is is
similar. We're not much off the hook on VOPs. How's that?
Okay. Well, it's a good question, but I am very concerned with the police officer's authority to detain someone without a court order or a crime under the Fourth Amendment.
Anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
Just on the double jeopardy portion, because I haven't spoke to that at all. Just I set forth this in our brief. Double jeopardy is absolutely not a concern. It would be different if, and this is what happened in United States versus Dixon, if the prosecution charged contempt and then a defendant was either acquitted or convicted of contempt and then brought a substantive charge. That's not occurring. And this court explained that in State versus Shanique Pway, right? As long as it's brought at the same time, it's not a double jeopardy concern. And the only question is to make sure you're not having excessive sentencing, and that can be addressed at the sentencing procedure with either the terms being concurrent or something like that. So double jeopardy is absolutely not. I mean, also, even if
they're brought at the same time and they're severed, take the person is held in contempt for possession of marijuana, mm-hmm. charged with possession of marijuana. Mm-hmm. The contempt proceeding goes first, guilty. Can you proceed with the prosecution of the marijuana?
No, because the mandatory joinder. Right? I think they have to be brought at the same time. Under the court rule, the case law. I think it's this, the same.
There might be a severance. I think it should. There's severance because because the jury finds out that there's an order out that was issued by a judge. That's one of the reasons for severance in these types of cases, no?
This court explained that in Shanique Pouet. I think the way to address that is to have the, the trial being bifurcated, where the jury learns about the underlying criminal activity and then comes up with their decision, and then you inform them of the order, and then the court explained that in Shanique Pouet. That's what's supposed to be.
Then you have multiple prosecutions for the same offense. You have overcharging. You don't think that those are legitimate concerns?
No. I mean, we do this every day in the domestic violence context, right? A person can be charged under 29.9 for a violation of a violence training order and an underlying crime at the same time. And this court specifically said that in Shanique Pouet. Double jeopardy concerns only arise if the state tries to seeks to try them separately, because it's not the case. It's here we do not need to address the issue. So I think as long as they're being brought at the same time, it's not double jeopardy concern. I think that's it.
Thank you. Thank you.
On behalf of the County Prosecutors Association in New Jersey, I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to, I guess, put myself on the hook. let me address the probation question, since it was the last one. The police have no authority to arrest anyone for a violation of probation unless there's a judicial order regarding a bench warrant or a failure to appear. So a probation officer can file a violation with the court, and then a court can issue a bench warrant, and then the police power comes to fruition in order to enforce the bench warrant. But that is one of the practical issues that exists right now. The County Prosecutors Association in New Jersey doesn't want to be presumptuous and say a judicial order. Sometimes it's an order and sometimes it's not an order. We read 2C29-9 was not repealed, altered, or modified in any way by criminal justice reform, which was a act designed to administer criminal justice in a different way.
What do you view the police authority to arrest if contempt, leaving aside the issue of no contact orders and other similar orders?
Absent
if contempt were not available, what would be the police authority to arrest for a violation of condition of release under the CJRA?
Absent a actual crime being committed in their presence while they were present, they would have none. There might be an exigent circumstance, community caretaking function at a minimal level, but absent a court issuing an order. Because if you look at the electronic monitoring context, which I think provides an idea of how...
No, I'm sorry. There's a court order. There's a detention order.
Sense of the electronic monitoring. When there's a violation of electronic monitoring, that's administered by the pretrial services program. A phone call is made to the police and said, hey, by the way, we're getting a violation. Here's the person's name. We'll get back to you. We're going to immediately try to get a bench warrant issued based upon that violation, which would then somehow the police then could enforce the bench warrant. But they would have to wait for that to be issued. This court is well aware between meetings and rulemakings, the public record is replete with the issues regarding electronic monitoring and how that has caused a lot of consternation. This court has indicated in, as recently State versus Mercedes, the practical implications of criminal justice reform should inform your decision making.
So the practical implication here is, and please tell me if you have a different view, is a more serious violation of a condition of release could result in the officer making an arrest on the spot if there's some criminal component. A lesser offense, like the ones that we asked about earlier in the argument, could result in somebody being hauled back into court and answering for that after the fact, but not an arrest in the moment for one of those lesser violations.
That would be my understanding. So, for example, a violation of a no-contact provision issued by a court, if the person was on monetary bail, which still exists even though it's frowned upon, under Gandhi, they could be arrested. It could support a contempt charge. If this court finds that the Criminal Justice Reform Act is somehow silently repealed 2C29-9, if it was a Criminal Justice Reform Act no contact order, then they would not be able to. And that's where confusion and issues where criminal justice reform also has a public safety component. And you asked the question about how does this fit in. At the end of the day, the criminal justice system is as a whole. Criminal justice reform was designed to administer the procedures a little bit differently. But
so let's just take McRae's case. There's the charge of theft, I believe, and maybe another charge, second charge as well. New offense. Absent the contempt charge, which was a factor in this case, would the police have the authority to arrest him?
Based on a new offense, they may have to get a complaint warrant if it wasn't in their presence, or they would still have to justify probable cause.
How is that any different than a violation of the conditions of release and going to a court and saying, issue a bench warrant because they represent a risk if they remain in the community? Is that possible?
I think there's some procedural issues. There might be some due process issues.
That's why I'm asking you.
There'd be procedural
issues. I haven't thought it through. I haven't been there for a long time. So
yes, sir.
Just curious.
The procedural issues, one, a defendant, because it's a motion to revoke, would have a right to be heard, would have a right to notice in some way, shape, or form. There is an appellate division decision that indicates a motion to revoke. You can't just grant it conditionally. The defendant has a right to be heard. So whether or not the police then had probable cause to arrest or to seize the person, with the contempt power, the probable cause determination would be, did the order exist? What is the condition? What have I observed that the condition is being violated? And how do I link the person that I see to that order? As this court's aware, and again, it's replete in the public record, one of the issues with electronic monitoring is there's no ability for the judiciary who's monitoring electronic monitoring to provide a photograph of the person who is on the electronic monitor. And the nature of those violations could occur in a town where no one knows who either the people are.
So is really this about probable cause?
It's about probable cause, and it's also about the County Prosecutor's Association of New Jersey. We're trying to be consistent from an intellectual standpoint and be honest from a practical standpoint. Gandhi has been on the books for a decade. Johnson has been on the books for almost a half a century. Correcki's been on the books since the 21st century. The prosecutors have not inundated the courts or inundated the system with contempt charges.
Can I just ask you the practical question, Matt?
Yes, sir.
In how many, and I asked your colleague, and I don't know that there isn't an answer. How often, if ever, where there's no new offense, but there is a violation of the conditions of release, does the contempt charge result in arrest?
I can speak in my experience being in Morris County.
That's a high crime county, so go ahead, use it.
And doing some training.
Watch it.
Under Gandhi, the contempt, no contact power was the one that was used. Very rarely would you have a condition on bail where a contempt charge independent would have been brought. Can I say it's happened? I would assume perhaps with turning in passports or you can't leave the state, those type of conditions.
In Gandhi, it started with a no-contact order that was separate and apart from any bail order.
Exactly. And this court in Johnson, that's why I think when you're asking about the legislative history of the CJRA, this court in 1972 said the court has the power to impose conditions on release. This court in Gandhi said that no-contact provision, and Gandhi was a no-contact provision, mm-hmm. It didn't lose its character as a judicial order.
So
I understand the court's frustration.
What's the nexus to the legislative history? You're saying that the legislature didn't think it was necessary because for such a long time contempt was a remedy for...
I think they're aware of this court's pronouncements. Gandhi is still the law in New Jersey today, and monetary bail still exists. And I'm coming towards the end of my career. Legislative history, legislative decision-making is not always easiest to glean. Counsel pointed out to the Extreme Risk Protective Order, and there's at least three committee reports from this court about how are we going to deal with the Extreme Risk Protective Order.
Or the legislature, after the first iteration, decided to take away the contempt power because they did not want to give prosecutors the authority to prosecute people for contempt for the failure to maintain employment, commence educational programs, or because they excessively used alcohol. That could have been one of their considerations, no?
Yes, and from a practical standpoint, the County Prosecutor Association of New Jersey is pointing out that we have no interest in bringing forth 130,000 contempt prosecutions, and we never did under Gandhi.
So I understand that, and they may have understood it too, but they still may not have wanted to leave it to the kindness of individual prosecutors in select counties.
Understood, but then it runs up against your doctrine that implied repealer is significantly frowned upon as a legislative choice, and when the legislature has cabined prosecutorial discretion, they have not done it through nuance or lemon juice on a letter. They are clear when they are doing that.
So
they did not modify the bail jumping statute. They did not modify the contempt statute. And
so forget about bail jump. Bail jumping is you don't appear in court. That's a bail jump. But was there a history of prosecutions for contempt for violations of bail, for curfews and all the other types of conditions that were released on monetary bail?
From my experience, they exist. Would they have been at the numbers? I can't tell the court the numbers. One of the problems is the Uniform Crime Report doesn't capture contempt as a reportable offense. And because contempt falls under also the Domestic Violence Act, to cabin those statistics, it's very, very difficult. What I can say is, one, the County Prosecutor's Association recognizes from a consistent intellectual approach that committing a new offense or failing to appear probably is not the fulcrum of what we're most concerned about, because in the sense of failing to appear, there is a bail jumping statute, a specific offense, just as we were saying, there's a contempt statute that talks about knowingly violating a judicial order. There's also precedent that this court has indicated and the appellate division has indicated that contempt really isn't the correct mechanism to assess when someone fails to appear, that bail jumping may necessarily fill the field. The County Prosecutor's Association of New Jersey believes, and in response also to your concerns about constitutional avoidance, we can't overlook that mandatory joinder will be a very practical limitation on some of the horribles that are being predicted if the contempt power remains. Mandatory joinder is not a constitutional requirement in some instances, and a defendant would also have the right under joinder to have whatever cases that are pending brought before a singular court for the purposes of disposition. So the County Prosecutors Association believes that the joinder rule will avoid some of the jeopardy issues or just some of the concerns about constitutional avoidance. There is no ambiguity regarding the contempt statute. It says if knowingly disobeying a judicial order. And following this court's precedent regarding implied repealer, there is a fairly reasonable reason why it may have been carved out, in the sense of the D.C. statute was a model, but the failure to appear model and the escalating penalties for contempt and failure to appear in the federal model is different than the fourth degree across the board model that New Jersey has for 2C29-9. That's just as a reasonable explanation. And under your precedent regarding implied repealer, if there's a reasonable interpretation, you will not presume implied repealer. This legislation, obviously, there were major stakeholders. There was ups and downs throughout the legislative process. There were administration changes. There were party changes. When you talk about the legislative history and the Joint Committee, which began criminal justice reform, but then it went through the Criminal Practice Committees, and in one of the rules reports, there are references that State versus Gandhi governs whether or not a new substantive offense of contempt could occur. I've been on the hook so long, I need a drink. But that the motion to revoke structure is its own thing. Even most recently, with the most recent criminal justice rules iterations regarding motion to revoke, it's recognized that the motion to revoke has its own section in the statute. It has different standards regarding a violation of condition. And with all due respect to my learned colleagues, their clients may think that jail is a punishment, pretrial detention, But the seven people in front of me and the nine people sitting in Washington, D.C. and the U.S. Supreme Court have made clear that pretrial detention is not punishment, that it is a regulatory mechanism. So there's no additional punishment if you violate a judicial order. And at some particular point, from an intellectual standpoint, the County Prosecutor's Association needs the contempt power at the front end.
It's no matter how you characterize it, it's a very strong deterrent. You violate a condition of your pretrial release, you go to jail. Whatever you characterize it, penalty, punishment, deterrence.
I'm old enough to remember life with 85% and the death penalty, and people still commit murders. I don't think a principled legislative enactment is necessarily tied to what a defendant may be for deterrent. What we need in law enforcement is, one, for the contempt to power to remain at its fullest. So at the time of the response, the police can, in fact, act to detain someone.
So I'm glad you went back there, because I'd like to get a better understanding of the need, the practical need that you've articulated. You've already agreed that for the more serious violations that may take place, the police can arrest, for the most part. Why is there a need for the contempt sanction, the fourth degree criminal offense, for these far more minor offenses, instead of allowing the process under the CJRA to unfold? What's that need?
Because public safety is at its biggest risk if a police officer arrives and then walks away and something dreadful, terrible happens.
Yeah.
And we're not dealing here. Again, we're dealing here where someone's been released. A court has told them you can't do something. I mean, I think that can't be divorced from our analysis to begin with. A judge has said, these are your conditions, you must abide by them.
So you draw no distinction, as I hear your answer, in terms of the safety of an officer between a de minimis violation and a very serious violation.
I don't mean to give that impression. I certainly, from a practical standpoint, as someone who would take that phone call and say, listen, are you going to authorize a charge for this particular offense, might be different than saying, take them into custody and we will sort out where we're at, because at this particular point, there's a circumstance, and this I don't think would be an unusual circumstance. A neighbor is told by a victim that there's a no-contact provision. It doesn't involve domestic violence. And the neighbor sees the person on the lawn, on the sidewalk outside that person's home, just standing there. And they call the police. Arguably, that's in violation of a no-contact provision. It may or may not be. If they're on the property, perhaps as a defiant trespass, but you're asking for the police to do a lot of nuanced analysis premised upon the idea that a court has told the defendant already, don't do this, you're not allowed to do this.
If your concern about having clear rules and guidance for the police is a very sensible one. If this court issued a decision that made crystal clear that no contact orders could be enforced as they could have been under Gandhi before, and police could make an arrest without a piece of paper, would that be adequate to address?
I think you would have to include the firearm condition at a minimum. I think you would have to include violations of electronic monitoring. I think you'd have to include violations of home detention, curfew. I think a curfew violation probably is a significant risk to the public safety, because at some particular point a court has decided that you need to be in a particular place at a particular time. The County Prosecutor's Association has no fundamental issue if the court decides for itself what you believe judicial orders are enforceable under the contempt power, but now you're interpreting 2C29-9. You can yourselves, I would submit, be able to create sort of an escalating ladder, and the practical implications from the prosecutor's office of wanting to charge contempt if someone's not working or not attending school, I think our institutional interest is at a fairly low ebb there. But there's no way for us to teach that, train that, make those decisions absent this court giving a clear ruling in that regard.
Well, it seemed like some of the suggestions you were coming up with were examples of where the order of release told an individual that they may not do certain things, like no contact, you may not act contrary to your electronic monitoring requirements, even curfew. You must be in your home and may not leave it during these hours. You can flip it and say it in the negative. The more murky areas are the ones that are more ambiguous, if you will, in terms of prohibited behavior. You know, you must engage or attempt to engage in employment and engage in educational programming. Is that what you're suggesting, to try to focus on aspects that are give clearer notice?
I think that, I'm not sure if it turns on notice, but it certainly turns on the idea that a court is exercising its power to tell somebody, you can't do something while you are subject to this court's jurisdiction.
Well, wouldn't that be, if just to put it back into a more familiar context, something that's more easily analyzed in the context of probable cause to believe that?
That would certainly be a workable standard that we could train the police and the police could be aware of. These are the type of, these conditions, this is the violation. Mm-hmm. If there's probable cause to believe that violation mm-hmm. is occurring, it falls under the ambit of 2C299. Contempt, and therefore you have probable cause to arrest for this
not,
new
not
substance
to confuse everyone, but when looks at the probation setting, the ability to arrest on probable cause sort of tracks, even for conditions, requires a probable cause determination before someone could be hauled in.
Correct, and that's made by
for a violation of a condition separate and apart from a new criminal activity.
Correct, and
right.
the probation officer files a violation based upon probable cause, and then a court issues process, but then can issue a bench warrant to bring that person before
correct.
The court.
But that's the authority to arrest. I'm
as
sorry.
As you respond to that, please bring your argument to a close as well.
I would also point out, when we're talking about the front end, the back end, and a person a couple days before trial with a no-contact provision, absent apart the Domestic Violence Act, begins to write letters that fall short of witness intimidation, fall short of tampering with a witness. I love you. I'm really sick. I can't believe this is going to happen to me. There's a no-contact provision. A court has told that person you can't have contact with them. The remedy is revoke release, perhaps. Now they're in jail. They continue to write the letters, because where do you go at that particular point? You've already been revoked. This court has made clear you've always had conditions to prescribe conduct, whether on bail or whether on release.
You may have witness intimidation. You have so many weapons in your arsenal.
If it's not with the statute, if we can prove that it's intended to intimidate the witness, absolutely.
Harassment. There is, I mean, so many statutes.
We're a little bit beyond your 5 minutes at this point.
Then I request permission to get off the hook.
Granted. Mr. Novick.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. There's been a lot of talk about the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act today, and that's where I want to start, because in the domestic violence context, the law couldn't be more clear that criminal contempt can be charged for violations of pretrial release conditions in a criminal domestic violence case. And let me explain why by reading the statutes. First is the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, 2C25-26. That's a provision about pretrial release in criminal domestic violence cases. And it says that in a domestic violence case, a criminal court, quote, may, as a condition of release, issue an order prohibiting contact with the victim, possession of firearms and other weapons, and in situations where it's warranted, as Mr. Shalom was mentioning, there's a provision about control over animals, which domestic abusers commonly use control over household pets as a way to intimidate their victims. So the legislature has spelled out the conditions that are appropriate specifically for domestic violence cases. And then it explains how we punish those. In 2C29-9B, you don't even need to look at A in the judicial order issue. Look at Section B. It incorporates the PDVA and says that it's a crime to violate any provision in an order entered under the provisions of the PDVA. So our position is that if you have a criminal domestic violence case and the court orders release under conditions prescribed in the PDVA 25-26, which are sometimes also authorized under the CJRA, but are also separately authorized under the PDVA, the legislature has said that violation of those conditions is specifically criminal. And that's the concern of our clients in this case, is that to do otherwise would subject domestic violence victims to risk. And Justice Solomon, I think you asked, why bother in a case where there's not an independent crime? And it's very important in the domestic violence context to bother with these cases, because often domestic abusers use violations of no contact provisions, even if they don't arise to a crime, even if it's not harassment, even if it's not stalking. It can be something very simple, but it's designed to control the victim, to threaten them, to prevent them from testifying in a criminal case. So the legislature has said very clearly that enforcement of these orders, even if it's in the criminal context, in a pretrial release order, is punishable as contempt. And it simply wouldn't make sense, and it's completely inconsistent with the statutory language, that if a domestic violence victim goes to the family part and gets a civil restraining order under other provisions of the PDVA, that's clearly punishable as contempt under Section B. And our position is that it's similarly subject to contempt under the PDVA in a criminal case if that order is issued in a domestic violence criminal case and authorized by NJSA 2C25-26.
Think more broadly to a case that is not rooted in criminal domestic violence, but a no-contact order with respect to a witness, to a victim in another setting. Help us with a principal distinction between that type of a violation and other conditions.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think there's a couple of answers to that question. One is Gandhi, which is a pre-CJRA case and certainly provides for a violation of a no-contact order being a contempt charge. And the case couldn't be more clear. I think there's some dispute in the briefs about whether it's dicta or it's holding, and I think it's clearly a holding that a violation of that order was contempt in that case. There's also NJSA 2C28-5.1, which I think the public defender mentioned briefly in their argument. That's a statute about protective orders if the defendant's going to obstruct justice. And that is also specifically punishable by contempt. That's in 29.9a. It's specifically incorporated into that statute. So that the 28.5.1 statute requires specific findings before you enter that type of protective order. But if you do, and that applies to defendants contacting victims as well as witnesses, and I believe it also applies to other parties to the case, not defendants, contacting victims for the purposes of obstruction, that's a clear case where the legislature has spoken as well. So those are some rules that the court could potentially use in cases outside of the domestic violence context. But what my clients are especially concerned about is domestic violence cases, and that has been spelled out by the legislature very clearly.
Questions, anyone?
Mm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Soto, rebuttal?
Unless this court has any other questions for me, I have nothing further to add.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel.